welcome back to CoronaCast. I'm Tilly.
And I'm Hannah Harris, and I'm a GP in South London, and this is our podcast about all things Corona.
Yep. In this episode, we're going to be doing an interview with Dr. Jonathan Round.
He's a consultant in paediatric intensive care at St. George's Hospital in South London, and he kindly took time out to talk to us about lots of different things, actually. We talked about what it's been like in paediatric intensive care and more about coronavirus and children.
Yep, we spoke about still kind of keeping up the conversation about any possible treatments.
And whether there might be a second wave coming up now that lockdown's been lifted.
Yep, we spoke about the impact on education within the NHS, like training new doctors and things like that.
And also we put the pandemic into context, in the context of history and previous pandemics and outbreaks. And it's really, really interesting, actually.
It's a good thing to think about. There may not have been something like this in our lifetime, but there has in the lifetime of humanity.
Yes, so we'll be coming on to that soon. But first of all, I wanted to do my disclaimer, which is that I'm a GP. I'm not an infectious diseases or public health expert. Opinions are all my own and not on behalf of an organisation. So we also, before the interview, wanted to just talk. Well, I wanted to talk to Tilly about her dad, because her dad, Jonathan, is currently suffering from coronavirus.
Yep, he had the diagnosis through this week, and I guess it put it into perspective a little bit. I think this is the case with a lot of things where, unless it's kind of directly affecting you, it's easy to shut out, and kind of you want to shut it out in a way. Like I've never denied the existence of the virus, but it has felt far away for me, especially as a young person. Like none of my friends have really suffered with it or anything.
Yeah, you've said that on previous episodes about how it feels far away.
Yeah, now it doesn't feel so far away.
Yeah, he went back to work, didn't he? Because he had to, and he must have picked it up there.
Well, I think so. Although, you know, people have their one exercise a day. I know he was going out for walks, so it could very well have been from that as well, because yeah, his girlfriend's got it as well.
Or a shop.
Anything. Mm. It is obviously worrying, because he is, I guess, a high-risk individual in terms of kind of who else we've seen who's been badly affected by coronavirus. At the moment, he's doing okay, he seems to be. It was a bit of a shock at first, because now it's suddenly very close and affecting someone who I love dearly. But it also, it's a weird thing. Once it happens, you live in fear of this virus and getting it, or someone around you getting it. And kind of once it happens, you have to take it in your stride and deal with it. At the beginning, I was quite worried. And now it's sort of a thing that's going on, and I check in with him. And yeah.
Yeah, sometimes the fear of something happening is actually worse than the thing happening itself. The kind of anticipation and the fear.
I check in with him every day. He seems okay. I'm taking every day as it comes. And if things get worse, we'll deal with it when that happens. But Yeah,
let's just talk through the symptoms that he had. So it started with feeling feverish, didn't it?
Yeah, he had a bit of a temperature one night. And then the next day, both him and his girlfriend felt quite ropey, like a temperature, a cough. Then the day after, he felt okay, but decided to get a test because he's a key worker, so he could get it. And sort of since the day of feeling quite ropey, the day after he felt better. And since then, he's sort of been saying that he felt the symptoms have got less and less. I mean, we're only in the first week and we know this virus can go on for a while, but...
Yeah, this is like day 9, isn't it? So
yeah,
fingers crossed he's had a mild illness, which is what most people have.
I feel it just really proves that we really don't know a lot about this virus, and it affects people in such different ways that... It's kind of made me think, you know, in my head when he was first diagnosed, I had these like thoughts about him being rushed to hospital. But I think because of how differently this seems to be affecting people and how little we know about it, you kind of just have to take every case as its own.
Yeah. And try not to be fearful of something that hasn't happened.
Yeah, exactly. You really have no idea what's going to happen with it. I feel we really don't.
Or with anything in life, really.
Yeah, exactly. But
well, thank you for that insight, Tilly.
Okay.
And now we're going to go on to our interview with Dr. Jonathan Round.
Over to him.
Hi,
Our guest on the podcast today is Dr. Jonathan Round. He's a consultant in paediatric intensive care at St. George's Hospital in South London with a subspecialism in cardiology. He's also head of the London School of Paediatrics, which means that he's responsible for all paediatric training across London, and he's head of paediatric training at St. George's Medical School. I was a medical student at St. George's and worked on a research project at the Paediatric Intensive Care Unit there in my final year, supervised by Jonathan. So he was something of a mentor to me. And his wife, Jane, was my first tutor when I started medical school 11 years ago. So we all go back a long way. And it's an enormous pleasure to welcome him as a guest on CoronaCast today.
And it's a great pleasure to be here as well, Hannah. Thank you very much for inviting me. A very kind introduction too.
It's an absolute pleasure. So lots of questions for you, as you cover lots of areas that we're really, really interested in terms of coronavirus. First of all, on the paediatric intensive care unit, how has it been in the last few months? Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, sure. I probably better just say that, you know, what I'm saying here are my views, and not necessarily the views of the organisations I represent, which is hope my attempt at trying to get out of any future legal problems. But I'll have to be a little bit careful again, just answering this, because, of course, these are real patients that we're talking about here. And so I'll be talking about patients in a more general regard rather than individuals. So to answer your question, yeah, we have seen like two or three going through the intensive care with this sort of new variant of Kawasaki, potentially linked to COVID so far in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. Could you just explain for our listeners what Kawasaki disease is?
Ah, yeah, sorry. Jargon buster. Thank you very much.
That's fine.
Kawasaki is, it's a sort of strange name, isn't it? It actually was picked up in around the 50s and 60s in Japan, where it was an inflammatory disorder. So the body developed high fever, rashes were seen, changes in the eyes, in the mouth, in the hands, were all part of this syndrome, which was picked up first in Japan and then elsewhere in the world. We have no idea what the trigger for this is, but what seems to happen is that the immune system gets excitable about something and starts damaging its own tissues and produces this characteristic pattern of what we call a vasculitis, i.e. an inflammation of the blood vessels.
Right,
now,
yeah.
Fortunately, it is benign in the sense that it tends to sort of go away on its own. But in some patients, there can be long-lasting damage, particularly to the coronary arteries.
So the heart,
that's right. So these are the arteries running and supplying the heart with blood. And it's one of the incredibly rare causes of a myocardial infarction in children. They normally don't have anything like this. So potentially quite an important disease to manage properly, but very, very rare, even in the UK.
Yeah. And so have you seen an increase in this since the onset of COVID-19?
Well, I think the first thing to say is this is the Kawasaki season. You tend to see more at this time of year. Again, we don't know why that is. But the kind of thinking around what the triggers might be is it might be environmental, it might be sort of semi-allergic, it might be viral, are the things that researchers have been trying to work on but not really found anything convincing.
Certainly with COVID-19, we do seem to be seeing this in patients sometime after the initial infection. In adults, certainly, I know more about this sort of multi-system inflammatory response, which it sounds like Kawasaki disease is also. So do you think there's
absolutely
a correlation there?
And it seems to be in a different age group as well. So the patients that we've seen have been typically much older, so teenagers, whereas the Kawasaki patients tend to be much younger. So, you know, under 5 would be typical for that. So, I mean, one of the questions is it caused by COVID? And it kind of looks like it almost certainly is, in the sense that they've found antibodies to COVID in lots of these patients with this new type of inflammatory disorder, but no actual COVID virus particles, implying that it's a response of the body to it.
It's the immune system kicking
off
rather than the virus itself. Just to thinking about parents who obviously will be very scared if their children contract coronavirus and the threat of this Kawasaki disease. What would you say to parents who are worried about it?
It's a very, very unlikely thing to happen. Now, this doesn't actually help if you are the parent, but it's because, you know, a very, very small chance of something happening is still really, really significant. However, the situation that you might experience is that the child would be basically fairly normal, have gone through a sort of a febrile illness, and then suddenly would develop sort of a high fever for a second time, and then would gradually get worse, perhaps, and develop some drowsiness. And that's the sort of typical features that you see with this new variant of that, or lethargy. Mm. And that's the time to actually go to hospital about that, or when there's a widespread rash. But it's really very unusual, and perhaps that's another thing that should be stressed. You know, we've had probably maybe about 100 cases worldwide that have been reported. It's that kind of number. But there's probably at least 1 million children being infected with COVID worldwide.
So yeah, numbers are actually very, very, very tiny, and it's very, very unlikely, but it's important that we know that it's a possibility.
Yeah,
that's right.
Okay, so it sounds like maybe the intensive care unit hasn't actually been too busy then.
Well, I think it was quite alarming for us actually how few patients were coming to the emergency department early on in this epidemic. Partly sort of for good reasons. For instance, part of the reason children come to the emergency department is with infections. Well, staying at home means you don't pick up infections from your mates at school. Also, you know, children have things like road traffic accidents, injuries in the playground, that kind of thing. Well, the playgrounds were closed and there was hardly anything on the roads. So there's good reasons why. But really worryingly was we were seeing children not presenting with things they would normally present with that can't be related to coronavirus, things like, say, leukemia and other cancers as well. And that the oncology services were seeing a big drop off in their referrals. So quite concerning, really.
Gosh, that is concerning, because that isn't anything that will have subsided. And you think the reason for that?
Why? I think it's just fear, really. I mean, I've spoken to a lot of parents in my clinic, because we switched our cardiology clinics from seeing the patient in a room, listening to their heart, taking a history, doing a scan, to everything done by telephone. And in fact, you can do quite a lot in a cardiology clinic by taking a really good history, but there's a lot you still can't do. And for patients who needed to come for further evaluation, often the parents would say, well, I'm really worried about coming into the hospital to get my child's heart evaluated because of coronavirus.
Yeah, sure. And you can understand why they'd be worried.
Yes. But it's all a balance of risk. And I think one thing you really learn as a medic is around balancing different risks and trying to work out, well, one thing has a downside, but the other thing might have a downside too. And sometimes it's difficult to make a call about what the relative risks of things are.
Okay. Could you talk us through what the good treatments are looking like at the moment?
There are various antiviral treatments that are undergoing trials. I'm unaware of anything showing great promise at this stage. The treatments that people have been showing a bit more promise have been ones that alter the immune system in one way or another. And so just to kind of wind back from that a tiny bit about COVID and what it seems to do to people. So it tends to, in adults, predominantly cause a respiratory infection in those who are likely to go on and die, which is a severe pneumonia. And that may be too much for some people. But in others, it seems to, in addition, cause an inflammatory response. And people are describing this as a cytokine storm. And this is, cytokines are like hormones that the immune system produces that affects how the immune system functions.
Yeah.
So it's like the internal messaging of the immune system. And these can cause very, very serious problems, and loss of cardiac output is a common problem that you get from this. So that's adults. In children, we're seeing much less of the respiratory problems, But we are seeing in the patients affected some of these immunological cytokine-related issues. And so that's why I think people have been focusing on what can we do about the cytokines. We have been using intravenous immunoglobulin, which is like a blood product, and you inject a lot of this. And it's basically blood, instead of when you give blood, instead of giving the red cells back to other people, you give the plasma, which is purified just for the immunoglobulins. Mm-hmm. And basically what this does when it goes into a patient is there's this massive flood of immunoglobulins, some of which are active against viruses that are around, but mostly it confuses the immune system, and so it doesn't really know what to do. And it effectively cuts down an immune response. And we've certainly seen a lot of success in Kawasaki disease with this. And it seems to work quite well in this COVID hyperinflammatory syndrome too.
And it's good to hear that, you know, very reassuring to hear that this syndrome is generally very treatable, even though children are very sick.
There have been a few deaths from this, but keep remembering how many children have been affected, maybe up to 1 million children worldwide. The problems that we've picked up, at least in this country, have been around a hypercoagulable status, which basically means that the blood is much more keen to clot than it should. And so you're getting thrombosis, that's clots, in some of the major blood vessels. And that can be quite a problem. They saw this as well in adults, so lots of pulmonary embolus and strokes. And so we've seen a bit of that in children too.
Yeah, and that kind of brings me on to a question that I personally have had recently, which I haven't found much to read about it. But I was wondering, I know I read that aspirin is sometimes used in the treatment of Kawasaki disease. And I was just wondering whether, like, people taking prophylactic aspirin.
What do you mean by prophylactic aspirin?
Prophylactic means taking something to prevent.
Okay.
Something happening. Whether taking aspirin could prevent these sort of clotting issues that we're seeing further down the line. Although I know that also ibuprofen is not recommended because it may cause complications, and that's in the same group as aspirin.
It's a very difficult time, and I think a lot of people are looking for security and certainty. It's totally, we're just making it up
to some extent
based on other conditions. So aspirin, well, you know, we see that patients are clotting too much, so we give things that reduce clotting. So a lot of patients, when they come in, will be put on heparin. Does that work? Well, we don't really know. What about aspirin? It's the same sort of thing. It's a less powerful clotting agent.
Yeah.
But then again, it's more likely to cause bleeding. The question around ibuprofen, yes, it's not recommended to take it if you think you've got COVID. And again, there's not really much in the way of decent evidence for this.
Sort of precautionary advice in a way, wasn't it?
I think so, yes. And I think the current advice is, if you're taking it anyway, carry on taking it. If you're not taking it, don't start it. I was just interested to ask Tilly, actually, you've been kind of scanning the news probably around this. Do you feel that anyone knows what they're doing in terms of giving good advice?
I'm obviously lucky to have Mum as a doctor, so I'm not totally in the dark about things, I feel, compared to like someone with no kind of medical person in their household. Like, I ask a lot of questions with her, and obviously she's doing a lot of research for the podcast, but to be honest, no, I don't really
particularly know, because I suppose nobody knows.
And I'm not seeing too much advice about, like, I'm obviously like on social media and stuff quite a lot. I'm not seeing too much advice about COVID and stuff like that. It's more political stuff, arguments for and against the lockdown being lifted and the way things are being handled and supporting the NHS rather than kind of, I don't feel like I see
advice.
Much. No, I really don't feel like I see much at all. And if I do, like 111, like my friend was talking to me today, she was going to call 111, and I told her to call her GP because I feel like it's better.
That's interesting, isn't it? I mean, one of the problems that's really come through this is the speed of the scientific cycle is so much slower than the speed of the political cycle.
Yep.
Like, for instance, if the three of us decided to set up a new research project investigating a particular drug for a particular condition. But it would probably take about maybe 2 to 3 years before we get any results. That's kind of normal.
A long time, yeah.
So that's the kind of typical life of a project. But here we would like to know answers yesterday. And you know, big questions like, you know, should we lift the lockdown? Well, you know, we're based on very simple epidemiological modelling, which is based probably on other viruses and guesstimates from what other countries are doing, which makes it very challenging, I think, for Boris and co.
Yeah, because they're having to make decisions based on no evidence, really.
Yeah.
Your question actually made me think of the other day when my dad's actually just been diagnosed with COVID, and he's a high risk individual if you kind of look at who gets quite badly affected by it. But then the advice he's been given is kind of go back to work if you haven't had a fever for 48 hours after day eight of your symptoms, even if you still have a cough. And I think now that it's sort of like, it's kind of more closer to home in terms of, you know, he's been diagnosed, that just doesn't seem right to me. That's such little time for his body to recover from this virus that we've seen has essentially put the world on hold. I feel if there is little evidence, then there's not enough caution being taken, I would say.
Well, there gets into big societal problems, doesn't it? Then it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
The big question is like, would he be still shedding the virus? Would be quite an important one to know. And currently, we do not know.
We're not really sure. Well, hopefully as testing, ramps up.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, it would be interesting, Hannah, is just perhaps to compare it to some other illnesses that we know about and how good the evidence is for that. We need more evidence. Well, how good is the evidence, say, for treating, like, say, a urinary tract infection or like a heart attack? Well, actually, the evidence is fairly good for the main treatments of these, but lots of things we don't really fully understand about around them. So, you know, we aren't in a position where we've got full evidence for everything. And almost always you have to try and apply what evidence you've got to the patient in front of you.
Yeah, yeah. Just one other treatment that I wanted to ask you about. We had a listener write in asking if we could discuss this. He found us on Instagram. His name's Brad. And he says, I'm originally from South Africa, but live in the UK. My question is that in South Africa and other African countries, a BCG vaccine has been seen as a massive positive in helping the immune system in fighting against COVID-19. Is this something the UK is looking into? If they are, what have they found thus far? And if not, why not? And okay. I wondered if you have a take on that, Jonathan.
Yeah, well, it's a really good question, isn't it? And this is one of the many kind of weird bits of epidemiology that's driving some of the big questions. And you could throw into it other big questions like this seems to affect Afro-Caribbeans, at least in our society, more than other racial groups. Particularly Caucasian seem to be less badly affected than other minority ethnic groups. Why is that? We don't know. What about obesity? Why does this have such a profound effect in this one? But let's try and answer Brad's question. Now, I think this came out from a paper from the US where they were looking epidemiologically at death rates in different countries and identified this really big discrepancy. I can't remember the exact number, but it's sort of five times that sort of number, less death rates in countries that seem to have had a widespread BCG vaccination program. You could look at it the other way around and say, well, the much, much higher death rate in countries that don't have a BCG vaccination program. So that's where it's come from. What I think we'd like to know is an intervention study.
And what would that be?
Yeah, this is where we give a country BCG vaccine and see if they get less COVID as a result or die less from it. My understanding from reading The Sun or whatever it was that this study actually hasn't been published yet. And this is something that seems to be a very big trend in COVID is that we've got lots and lots of studies that haven't been published that are being used as evidence.
And haven't been, that means they haven't been peer reviewed, which is a really important part of the publication process, isn't it?
Absolutely. Which basically means they might have done some things with terrible methodology, and the results have got no real credibility to them. But we are have abandoned that because we're really keen to know about what they've found out. So, I mean, I'm not saying that it's not true, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't think about this, but it doesn't have the same kind of quality of information that you might get from something that's been through a really good, rigorous review process.
Mm-hmm. And we need to be really mindful about that when we're reading these studies and these possible treatments, possible approaches.
But we should probably look into it a tiny bit more, because it's very interesting that, because it's a massive difference. It's probably fair to say that countries who have a BCG vaccination program are quite different to countries that don't have a BCG vaccination program. They're likely to have less elderly people because of the general poverty in these countries. And they're likely to have had a very different type of viruses and bacteria already in their respiratory tract. And this may protect against coronaviruses in ways that we just don't understand at the moment. So always the key question is not what is there an association, but does an intervention make a difference? And that's a really important question to answer. Otherwise, lots of things that are an association will be taken as causation. And that's a big problem.
Mm. Can I just ask, because I didn't actually get the BCG vaccine, what was it for to vaccinate against originally?
Oh dear, I don't know if your mum has a big scar on her top of her left arm.
Yeah, I've had it somewhere.
But I certainly have. So it stands for Bacille Calmette-Guérin, I think it is, which is, it's a vaccination against tuberculosis.
Okay.
Essentially what they did was they took some tuberculosis bacteria, altered them by a process I failed to understand, so that they don't give you full TB, and then they actually inject them under your skin when you're a teenager. And this forms a little abscess there, and in learning about the abscess, your immune system also learns how to prevent you catching TB.
Smart.
And so it's an immunization against it. So that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, and supposedly it modulates the immune system in some way that may be... may somehow be beneficial. That's what the speculation has been anyway, in terms of the immune system and COVID-19, but I think we just don't understand that.
Who knows? So coming back to Brad's question, I think being in a country where they have the BCG vaccination seems to be a benefit, but whether it's the BCG vaccination or something else about the country or the population, we have no idea. If you haven't had the BCG vaccination, do not go out and get a BCG vaccination off Amazon and inject yourself, because it's very unlikely to be helpful for you. I think it's probably my bottom line based on this, but watch that space, because I think there's a couple of trials that are ongoing or have just started to look at this specific thing.
Okay, we'll look out for that. Thank you for that. Excellent advice. Not never really wise to acquire treatments on the internet. Okay, so now, Jonathan, if we could move on to talking about lockdown.
Ah, yes.
And sort of the public health side of things a little bit. So in London today, apparently the R number is now around 0.4, and there are only about 24 new cases per day being reported. But also this week we've started to release lockdown in quite a major way, I would say. So do you think we are looking at a second wave?
Too many questions. I think
okay.
I think the first thing to say is that I feel very sorry for Boris and crew, who have to try and make public health policy out of what we know at the moment and balance two really gigantic things. Even if you just looked at mortality, not basic happiness of people, there's substantial mortality from a contraction of the economy, and people know what this is. I don't know what the number it is, but there is an excess number of deaths in the tens of thousands for each GDP point we go down. And
very important.
You have to balance that against deaths from something else. And whatever you choose, there will always be people who think it's too lax or other people who think it's not relaxed enough. Mm. And I saw yesterday the teachers' union saying, you know, how can you let the children come back to school? So it's impossible, isn't it? It's impossible, but you've got to do something.
It's a difficult, impossible line to tread.
Exactly. What do you do? What do you start with? I think it's really, I mean, if I was doing this, I'd kind of draw up a league table of things that are maximally disruptive to society. And I'd draw up another league table of things that are maximally damaging to the health of people, and try and work out what was low on one and what was high on the other, and try and steer a path through. That would be kind of how I'd do it.
Yeah, in the absence of really very good evidence, I guess, you know.
So there's sort of various bits of evidence that come from some of this contact tracing data from around the world. There seems to be quite a lot of difficulty in the coronavirus surviving out of doors. And that's why we've got this relaxation of out-of-door stuff. So it's much easier, and there's been much more evidence of people catching it from other contacts indoors.
Enclosed, non-ventilated spaces.
Yes. And we think this is probably because the virus, when I'm talking at the moment, if I had COVID, I would be shedding virus all the time as I talk, but in microparticles, which dry within about 0.1 of a second. So there's no risk, even if you were sitting kind of right next to me, of you catching coronavirus just from that activity. The problem is these bigger droplets, which hang around for quite a bit longer and can sit on surfaces. And that's why masks are quite useful in terms of preventing you shedding the virus to somebody else. So that's, I think, behind this sort of external lockdown, and presumably these micro droplets dry out even faster out of doors than indoors.
Yeah. And now the weather's warming up, we can certainly all get outside and socialise outside potentially. So that's...
Yes, but only with one person 2 metres apart.
Yeah. the other side of things is this thing about herd immunity. And there seems to be research coming through that shows herd immunity may be achieved a lot more quickly than was originally thought. So perhaps rather than sort of 50% to 60% of people needing to have had the virus for there to be herd immunity, it might be as low as 17% to 25%.
Okay. Well, it's a problem, isn't it? Because basically, a virus like this, assuming that no one has any immunity to it, will spread exponentially. And one of the breaks to that is increasingly encountering people who've already had it or have some sort of immunity to it.
Mm.
And people thought that this might be up to 60% is where you'd need to before it really started biting at the R rate. But of course, you know, anyone that even at 1%, it's going to reduce it a little bit.
Yeah, but it sounds like it might happen more quickly than the modelling originally thought. So hopefully, fingers crossed.
But I think, you know, if I was running the country, which thankfully I'm not, one of the things I'd try and do is combine this sort of phased reduction with very, very careful and huge amounts of evidence gathering in the field to try and work out what of the interventions is making a difference. Because it may be that, for instance, you know, opening schools doesn't make any difference at all, but actually opening indoor workplaces does make a really big difference. But we won't know if we're just monitoring deaths.
Yeah.
So monitoring infections is going to be incredibly important going forwards.
Yeah, we really need the testing, like testing to be ubiquitous for this monitoring to take place properly, don't we? Do you have a view on schools going back yourself then? You know, it would appear that schools are kind of hotbeds of infection.
But are they hotbeds of corona infection is a good question.
Yeah, are children super spreaders or not?
Well, probably the answer is no, actually. And the evidence we've got so far around this is that they're not super spreaders. The Chinese series that looked at this found, I think, only one individual case where it was thought that the child had brought the infection into the family. And almost always it was the parents that were actually doing the spreading. The other piece of useful factish stuff in there is that when you actually look for the coronavirus in children as opposed to adults, you find they're much less likely to be infected than adults, ranging from a half as likely to only a third as likely, Why? We don't know, but it's probably something to do with the bugs that are already up children's noses and their experience of dealing with coronavirus, which is coronavirus anyway is a fairly common thing to find up a child's nose. It's just this new variant, the COVID-19, which is a new one. So it may be that actually it might be a very smart move to open up schools, because it doesn't look as though children will get as infected and may not pass it on as much as adults would.
Hopefully that's the case.
Yeah. We'll see. That's, I mean, good, I think what would be very, very sad is if children were deprived of their ability to get educated and socialise at the moment. And I saw some pictures a couple of days ago of these poor French kids playing in a 2 metre square box.
I saw that.
And that made me weep. You know, they're incredibly social. They're touching each other. I mean, really, social distancing? I don't think so. And how do we actually handle that in the long term? You know, I don't know.
But yeah, if immunity is conferred on them partially by the coronavirus is already in the nose, like the common cold, then yeah, perhaps it's the best thing to let them go to school. I would love to talk a bit more about the impact that this is all having from your point of view. You know, there is obviously a huge impact on the rest of the running of the NHS with what's happening with coronavirus and in the education and training of doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals. And can you talk to us a bit about that and what the implications are there?
Yeah, everything has been affected. And I think it's always worthwhile zooming out and noting the tens of thousands of people who've died in this country. And all the families, and you know, people say, well, it's affected this badly or that badly. Actually, it's affected other people much, much worse. And that our students can't go to college at the moment because of this. We do have to bear that in mind, that there's many people getting worse off.
Absolutely.
But that said, you know, actually, well, how do we train our next generation of doctors? And other healthcare professionals? You can't really do it from endless Zooms. And you know, we've been doing lots of Microsoft Teams stuff. And at some point, we're going to have to send our students back in to actually see real patients. And I'm not sure why we haven't done it already. This is my personal opinion here, on the grounds that, well, you know, we've got to get them used to dealing with PPE and potentially infectious patients, and surely shouldn't we be just teaching them how to do that? I think up to now we've had such a shortage of some of these things like PPE, well, perhaps we can't really spare it for medical students. But we have to get to a position where we can do this, and I think it's essential that as a country we work out what we have to get up and running as soon as possible. And that will probably be something that we have to do, get up and running ASAP.
Yeah, it has seemed like there's a reluctance by universities, medical students or wherever the healthcare students are, in terms of not wanting to expose them to the virus in the course of their training. Do you think now there's a push to get them back in?
Certainly a push coming from the students themselves.
Right.
There's really two aspects to that. There's first of all the danger to the students themselves, plus the potential that they might pass on infection to other people. Mostly they're young, so they're not going to be affected. You know, one or two people of much younger age have succumbed to COVID, but it's a very rare occurrence. The other issue is anyone going to have any time to teach them? I think there's probably another issue as well, which is, are there any patients that don't have COVID? And that's currently a no. So, you know, we've got quite a lot to get up and running in that. But overall, I think we have to move to a situation where we say, let's start the NHS working like it needs to. Let's stop this sort of unwanted mortality of non-COVID issues, and let's train our next generation.
Yeah, we need these. We need these newly qualified doctors, nurses, other health professionals to start coming through. I suppose it's not just the kind of people who are about to newly qualify, but doctors in training, so people who've already, say, qualified as doctors who have taken up, for example, paediatrics. You must be seeing sort of problems in their training too, because everyone's talking about COVID-19.
I think for many of us, it's driven us up the wall because everything's changed and processes that we'd evolved over decades that actually offered pretty good balance of training are just thrown away in a trice. What we saw at first is that pretty much everyone that could hold a stethoscope was moved into COVID-related activities and away from their parent specialty. And the more junior you were, i.e. The more kind of pluripotent you were, the more you were sent. I offered my services, but I think I was too old and too pediatric to go and help.
Stuck in your pediatric zone.
Yeah, but a lot of the trainees that I work with and look after their programs have been moved to adult places, including things like the Nightingale and other adult areas. Now it's time for them to move back, but there does seem a bit of reluctance because of this potential second wave.
Yeah. Do you put it all back again and then have to undo it and send people out again?
Well, I don't know. I mean, currently we're working on actually everybody coming back into where they should be in September. But it might be one of these things where, unless we actually say we're going to do this, everyone will kind of drift along. But that's our plan, is everyone's back where they should be in September.
Great. And then I guess if things change, then you'll have to be flexible, and
exactly.
That's life.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, finally, I wanted to talk about the biggest topic, really. Look at the big picture and talk about the pandemic and its place in history.
Yes.
I know that's something that you're quite interested in.
Well, only just as a kind of observer, really, of how things move forward. Every now and again, humanity gets really big challenges. And if you think this is an unprecedented time, I'm not so sure you're quite right. Certainly what we're doing is unprecedented. But imagine you lived in, say, 1650, 1660. Every now and again, this wave of devastation would come through where all of your friends and your family would suddenly develop fevers, become very sick, your fingers would go black, you'd get these big boils, and then you would die. Okay, that's a black plague. If you lived in many other eras, you'd have experienced the situation where apparently perfectly healthy people would suddenly get terrible diarrhea. This diarrhea would continue and continue, then you become increasingly delirious, cold, and again die. So that's cholera.
Yeah.
The next really big pandemic would be the one of the Spanish flu. Remember, in those days, they discovered bacteria, but not viruses. So this was a non-bacterial cause of fever. Mm. What was going on there? And all of these people would develop a cough and a fever. And although many would recover, many others wouldn't. As well. So, actually, is this unprecedented? Well, the idea of having a disease that is very dangerous, that we don't know about what the cause is, we don't know how it works, is not a new thing, but we just haven't seen it for so very, very long. And how society responds to this is fascinating, actually, because this is the first time I think we've understood what the causative agent is of all of those pandemics, and understood a little bit about what we might be able to do for it. Mm. And we've so far only gone down the epidemiology routes. So I think, this isn't unprecedented, would you disagree with me, Hannah?
No, I suppose you could say it's unprecedented for this generation, like in our lifetime, we haven't seen this before, but that's a very blinkered view, actually, isn't it? Because history goes back a very, very long way. And yeah, it's a brilliant point that you make. I totally agree with you. This has actually been seen time and again throughout history for human beings, families having to deal with things like this. And we're kind of unprecedented in the fact that we haven't seen it.
Yeah, the only thing I can compare it to in my lifetime is like swine flu. I remember when I was really young and we would drive to school and I could hear on the radio all of this stuff about swine flu. But then I guess it never really got this far.
Yes, so it turned out to be just a nasty flu, that one did. What's interesting is how society responds to it. The cholera is basically a disease of large towns, really, because it was only when you got a potential contamination of your water supply by somebody else's cholera feces, that you would potentially have an epidemic of cholera in your area. So small villages didn't really have an issue with this because there just weren't enough people. But as towns got bigger, it became a problem. And then almost by chance, the whole business with John Snow and the need for clean water, and he worked out what was going on, even though he's still about 100 years away from identifying bacteria. So clever man. But yeah, so how does society move forward? You know, actually, this tells us that we need to preserve our water supply was something that really came out of that one. This one, the modern health service can probably be traced back to Spanish flu and how you actually manage sort of large numbers of people, contact tracing, all that can be linked back to that as an issue. But this, I mean, this is bound to have some effect on society. And it's these mass healthcare panics that lead to change in society. And I suspect we'll be seeing exactly the same as a long-term outcome from this.
Yeah, yeah. There are going to be really far-reaching effects, aren't there, for everybody?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. What will it be like when this is over? If it ever is?
What's interesting is that coronaviruses tend to sort of disappear after a couple of years. We don't know why.
Do they?
Well, what happened to SARS?
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of gone, hasn't it, I guess? We're not getting outbreaks of that anymore.
No, it's disappeared. And so places like South Korea and Singapore had a very sort of big problem with it, but did a lot. Places like Indonesia also had a big problem, didn't do a lot about it, and both saw it disappear in pretty much the same way.
Ooh, so that's a very positive note, isn't it?
Yeah, so everyone.
Maybe it's just
worse comes to worse. 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. Seems a long time to wait.
Yeah, but, it does.
Well, yeah. Let's see. Well, thank you so much for talking to us, Jonathan. That was brilliant. We've been through almost every aspect of coronavirus, I think. And,
oh my goodness.
And it was super enlightening.
It's been really nice chatting with you too as well. Keep well, keep safe.
Yeah,
all right,
you
guys.
Too. Love to the family. Thanks.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much to Jonathan for that interview. That was really, really great.
Yeah, we really enjoyed our chat with him. We covered so much. And it really gave us the insight and emphasised that there is so much that we don't know, and it's really important to remember that.
Yeah, like just as I was saying at the beginning of this episode, like it's so hard to take, it really made me think it's so hard to take the right steps for anyone, whether you're a member of the public or the Prime Minister or a doctor, to take the right, know what the right step is when there's so little that we know.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's why we have to show a bit of sympathy to the government, because they are feeling their way as much as anybody else.
Yeah. But it also makes me think, as what I said, you know, you need to be cautious if there's very little, you know, like we can't just, I don't think it would be wise to suddenly have a big gathering or whatever when we just don't know anything.
We should definitely be erring on the side of caution. And it's really important not to experiment with different treatments and sort of rush through the science, because that's a really dangerous way to operate.
Yeah, that could do far more damage than the virus itself. It's really important to remember that.
Yeah, it's great that with the development of the vaccine, sort of shortcuts in the process side of things are being made. But again, in our episode where we interviewed Professor Beata Kampmann, she said, you know, you cannot take shortcuts when it comes to safety of drugs and vaccines.
Not an option.
So thank you to Jonathan.
Yep. It was also kind of comforting talking about the history of pandemics within humanity, wasn't it?
Yeah, making us realise that lots of generations have actually been through very similar situations themselves before.
Yeah, and we've got this in a time where medical science is far more advanced, so maybe we've got an advantage there.
Yeah, and on an individual level it can be really, really awful and traumatising. But hopefully there is some comfort in remembering that past generations have seen this kind of thing and got through it.
We're still here.
We're built to deal with this kind of thing, really.
Exactly. On to the positivity. So my positive news is that I started a book. When did I start it? Was it last week? I think it was last week. I've nearly finished it now. It is the book A Thousand Splendid Suns by Khaled Hosseini.
So Hero, the kite runner.
Yeah. And it's so good. Like, I was reading a bit of nonfiction before and I was enjoying it, but with social media and things like that, there's a lot of shouting at the moment. And it's so nice to just completely read and immerse myself in this completely different world. Like, it's set in Afghanistan about these two girls. And it's so good and so insightful. And it's written really well. Like, it really takes you to a different place. And I love it so much. It's been a very comforting piece of literature in this time.
She's had her nose in a book the whole time, which has been really lovely to see, actually. And my positive news is just that I've been doing loads of exercise this week. I've been doing yoga. I've been training with my amazing personal trainer friend Sam on Zoom in a group, and I've been going out running as well, and I'm trying to do this running program to do 10k and like build up to 10k in 10 weeks, which I did years ago, and haven't really done much recently. So I've been really enjoying that, eating healthily, and by contrast with our past episodes when we were talking about eating 3 Easter eggs in a weekend, we've moved on.
We've cut down, but we still have chocolate in our lives, don't we?
There is occasional chocolate, yeah. We're on a health kick and it feels good.
Yeah, but do what feels right at the time.
So that's it for us this episode. Yep.
Thank you so much for listening, and thank you again to Jonathan for doing the interview.
Thanks to Brad for his question that we answered in the interview. And please send in more questions to questions@coronacast.co.uk by email.
Or you can find us on social media on Twitter and Instagram called @thecoronacast.
Yeah, please get in touch. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Stay safe.
Bye.